Do you want to call it time? It's not CMU time.
It's not CMU. Okay, one more minute. There are two more chairs at the best rows in the house.
Is this it? Is this the last seminar of the semester?
Yes.
Are you going to have some special thing you're going to do?
Oh, there is a DG right afterwards.
Okay.
Should we start, Alexi?
Yeah.
All right. It's my pleasure today to introduce Andrew Ng, a good friend of both the Institute and mine for many years now. Probably not all of you are aware of this, but Andrew is a former CMU person, spent time in glorious Pittsburgh, working in the Auton Lab back in the day. From the Auton Lab, he went on to work with Michael Jordan in machine learning, and I guess he toured the country hitting MIT first and then Berkeley. Andrew became a superstar in machine learning, doing work that's famous in reinforcement learning and supervised learning. And since then, I guess he's moved on to applying learning in robotics applications in addition to the work he's done in straight learning. So I think today he's going to tell us all about some of this work in machine learning applied to robotics. So, Andrew?
Cool. Thanks, Drew. Thanks for having me here. So what I want to do today is tell you about the STAIR project. STAIR stands for Stanford AI Robot. And I'm going to use this talk to tell you about STAIR, but also use it as a unifying theme to showcase various satellite projects. So the STAIR project was motivated in part by the observation that over the last 30 years, the field of AI, the field of artificial intelligence, has fragmented into many different subfields. And today, you know, each of these boxes represents almost a separate conference, almost a separate research community. And so about 9 of my colleagues and I at Stanford wanted to see if we can define unifying challenge problems that will require integrating all of these disparate spheres of AI onto a single robot platform. There have been many projects like these before, and if you're still familiar with the history of AI, I think of STAIR as very much a project that's in the tradition of Shakey and Flakey. So sort of Shakey was a 1966 project, and so I think of this as revisiting the sort of AI problem, but using, you know, 2007 AI technology rather than 1966 AI technology. These are the long-term challenge problems we set for ourselves on STAIR. These are sort of 10-year challenge problems, things like having the same robot tidy up a room, load the dishwasher, fetch an item in response to verbal requests, use tools to assemble a bookshelf, prepare meals. And over the short term, and what I'm going to sort of report on our progress on today, is trying to get a robot to fetch an item from an office. So concretely, what I'm going to talk about are elements that we're tying together to try to do this. So talk about mobile manipulation, object recognition, 3D perception, and grasping. So here's the outline. I'm going to start by talking about class of apprenticeship learning algorithms and number of other robots we apply them to and how we apply them to the STAIR robot. So to motivate what I'm going to talk about on apprenticeship learning, here's a picture of a different robot. Here's a picture of the Stanford Autonomous Helicopter. And like most other autonomous helicopters, ours is instrumented with a GPS, with accelerometers, an IMU, a magnetometer or compass, wireless and onboard computer. And so if I were to give you the keys to this helicopter and ask you to write a program to fly it, how would you go about doing so? So let me just start by showing you a video, an example video of a helicopter in autonomous flight. This is a video of a helicopter using a learned controller to fly sort of under computer control. And so this is, again, computer-controlled flight. And when we zoom out the camera, you see the trees planted in the sky. And so this is one of the more, maybe one of the most difficult aerobatic maneuvers flown autonomously on any helicopter. So it turns out there are maybe about half a dozen research groups in the United States alone that work on autonomous helicopters. So some of the most noteworthy ones, the one at CMU with the very cool lasers that you guys have, Eric Ferrand's group, so recently, that was until recently at MIT. here's a slide that serves to distinguish what we do from what many other, not all, but many other groups do. So this is what I think of as the classical approach to control, right? You build a helicopter with a GPS and accelerometers. Your sensor readings feed into a Kalman filter to give you state or position estimates for the helicopter. You want to come up with a controller to input positions and output controls. And the way a controller is often designed is by about 1,000 hours of hand tuning. And that number is actually about right. 1,000 hours is 6 months of a full-time engineer's time. That's actually about right. On the Stanford helicopter, we used a reinforcement learning algorithm to fly it. And as I say, Drew and Jeff here at CMU were actually the first to get RL to work on the helicopter. But concretely, what we did was, like everyone else, we have a GPS and IMU feeding into Kalman filter to give us state or position estimates. What we did was then ask a human pilot to fly the helicopter around for us for about 3.5 minutes in our case. By watching how the helicopter responds to the human pilot control inputs, we then learn a model of the dynamics. The model is fed to what's called a reinforcement learning algorithm, which runs for about 10 minutes, and that outputs a controller. So just now, you saw the video of the helicopter flying upside down. So the time between when we finish building the mechanical helicopter, the time we finish putting through the helicopter hardware, and the time when that video was made was less than 72 hours, including time for us to sleep and so on. And so this is really, I think, represents a very short control design cycle. A few more words on the reinforcement learning formalism that we do a lot of this work in.
Worked for the first time?
It worked the second time.
and the first time.
Yeah, and so the first failure was actually something that we're going to talk about the class of apprenticeship learning algorithms. It turned out the reward function we chose was wrong, and we have a class of apprenticeship learning algorithms for fixing reward function. So. I've lost count of the number of times we've crashed. So here's a formalism that reinforcement learning algorithms use. At every time step, we assume that our helicopter is in some state st. So at time 0, it starts off in some state s0. You get to choose a set of actions, a0, so where to move the control sticks. And depending on your choice of action, your helicopter will randomly transition to some new state s1. And then you do this again. Choose some new action A1, your helicopter transitions to the new state or some new position S2, and so on. And you do this for a total of T time steps. So your helicopter flies through a sequence of states S0, S1, S2, up to ST. So the key idea of reinforcement learning is this thing called a reward function. For example, a reward function may be this sort of quadratic cost function, where if your goal is to hover at a position S star, your reward may be this sort of quadratic penalty function if your helicopter is in S and you actually want to be at S star. After your helicopter flies through the sequence of states, we take the reward function and we apply it to each of these states in the sequence, and we add them up. And we call that the total utility of this trajectory you just flew through. And the goal of a reinforcement learning algorithm is to pick actions over time so as to maximize the expected value of this total utility. Okay? So in reinforcement learning, the key input is sort of the reward function, which I think of as a way, and indeed in optimal control also. The key input is this reward function, a cost function, which I think of as a way to allow you to specify what you want done rather than how you want it done. And it turns out that in specifying this reward function is often non-trivial. So to develop the class of apprenticeship learning algorithms that we'll talk about, let me actually go ahead and sort of invite you to look at another example of a robot. So this is a robot designed and built by Lockheed Martin, which we're collaborating with. I think CMU has a bunch of robots that are a bit like this too. So as many of you know, right, so cars and trucks are the most fuel-efficient robots in the world. But cars and trucks can access maybe about 50% of the planet's land surface area. In contrast, legged animals like humans can access almost 100% of the planet's land surface area, but legged robots are also much less fuel efficient. So this is a robot designed by Lockheed Martin to try to take advantage of, on the one hand, the fuel efficiency of wheeled robots, and on the other hand, the ability of legged animals, legged robots, to climb over obstacles. And so we're working with them for developing controllers for this robot. So what do you do? Here's a simulator of the robot. You give a reinforcement learning algorithm a reward of +1 for reaching the goal. So we want the robot to climb on top of this obstacle. And we run a reinforcement learning algorithm. It does a beautiful job maximizing reward function, but you know, not so great scraping this rear part on the ground as it otherwise does a great job climbing on top of a step. So many of you who've worked in optical control of reinforcement learning will have seen stuff like this before, where you specify the obvious reward function, give it a dollar for climbing on top of the obstacle, and it does something that maximizes the reward but wasn't quite what you wanted. So solution is actually obvious. It's just, you know, add a penalty for scraping, and that clearly fixes. Oh, excuse me. Okay. So when this happens, the solution is sort of fairly obvious. You just add a reward. You modify the reward function to add a penalty for the robot scraping itself on the ground, and now it, you know, gets on top of the obstacle. Except that, play that video game. Actually, right here is the wheels spinning on the ground, pushing against the front face of the step, and sort of right, vulcanized rubber tire spinning against the ground. Probably not what you want the robot to do either. And so, it turned out that we modified the reward function once, but there was one more thing we forgot, which is we don't want, you know, the tire spinning on the ground either. So we modify the reward function just one more time, and finally, you get out the behavior that you want. And this is, think of this as an illustration of a fairly common design process in reinforcement learning and optimal control, right? And this is this step has an angle relative to the robot, so this makes it slightly more interesting, or a slightly more non-trivial gain. Actually, right there, the front two tires rubbed against each other. So we forgot one more thing. This happens a lot. Until finally, this is a real robot, so this is last time, promise. This one will work. Until finally, after sequentially modifying the reward function a whole bunch of times, the reinforcement learning algorithm does a great job maximizing reward function, and it finally you know, finds a gate to climb on top of the obstacle. And I should say, then this is, I actually like this, the algorithm's output, I guess. This robot has 12 independent control degrees of freedom. So, you know, if you have, I don't know, 12 joysticks to control it, that's sort of more joysticks than you have fingers. But it finds, you know, I think reasonably complex, but reasonably nice gates for, in this case, climbing on top of an obstacle. So, a key problem, I think, in reinforcement learning is how to specify this thing called the reward function. And in practice, people tend to tweak them a lot. So at Stanford, one of my students, Peter Abiu, and I did was develop a class of apprenticeship learning algorithms that attempt to solve the reinforcement learning problem. And what I'm going to do is to describe this work, I'm going to use sort of yet a third motivating example of highway driving. So if you think about teaching like a 16-year-old, you know, to drive, the reinforcement learning approach would say, well, you sit down with a 16-year-old kid, tell them what the reward function is, and let them go optimize it. And that's not how any of us teach anyone to drive. I think even though, you know, most of us probably drive reasonably well, all of us have a very hard time articulating just what is the reward function or cost function we're optimizing when you drive. Because when you drive, you automatically trade off lots of different desiderata, such as maintaining reasonable speed, you don't want to hit other cars, you really don't want to hit pedestrians, you want to stay sort of far from the curb, keep out of people's blind spots, maybe you like the middle lane a bit more, and so on and so on and so on. And it's actually very hard for us to articulate how we trade off these different desiderata. So the question is, given just a demonstration of driving, is it possible to watch? This is a demonstration of my student Peter Abiu driving this blue car here. Oh, thanks, Alicia. Given just a demonstration of driving, is it possible for an algorithm to learn to drive in the same style? His car is hardwired to go faster than all the others, so he has to weave around traffic. So it turns out there's a fair amount of prior art in sort of apprenticeship learning, also called imitation learning, including some done by, I guess, Chris Atkinson. And in this talk, I'm going to present a somewhat different class of algorithms that rather than trying to learn a control policy directly, we try to recover the reward function that the human driver was demonstrating and use that to learn, you know, to try to do optimal control ourselves. In fact, the entire field of reinforcement learning, so the entire field of optimal control is, I think, predicated on the assumption that the reward function is the most compact and transferable definition of a task. And so I think that means trying to learn the reward function is a perfectly natural approach to try to learn from a demonstration. And I should say that also Nathan Radcliffe, Drew Bagnell have also done sort of similar works, with related work that we'll talk about here. So here's the algorithm. It's an algorithm in two steps. I'm going to watch the, you know, Peter, watch a human expert drive a car. And then we're going to try to estimate a reward function R of S such that under that reward function, the expert is Peter driving the car. It looks like Peter is driving the car better than any controller we previously found. The other step of this algorithm is then, having just guessed the reward function here, we then compute the octal controller for the reward that we just guessed. Can you just iterate these two steps? Say more about the first step in a minute, but it turns out what you can prove is that this algorithm will find a controller that performs nearly as well as the expert demonstrating the task, where here we're going to evaluate performance according to the expert's unknown reward function, R star of S. Okay? So it turns out that when Peter is driving a car, maybe he's trying to optimize some reward function, it actually turns out to be impossible to figure out what Peter's reward function is just from watching him drive a car. Nevertheless, what you can prove is somewhat non-intuitive result that no matter what his reward function is, and you never know what his reward function really was, you will do nearly as well as he did as evaluated on his sort of unknown and unknowable reward function. Okay? Some details. This result is fully general for finite reinforcement learning problems, finite MDPs, and we assume linear function approximation for the reward function in infinite state MDPs. Let me just say in sort of half a slide a little bit more about what this guess reward function step is. This is by far the most technical slide of this entire talk. So in the T federation of this algorithm, we will have found some set of policies pi 1 up to pi t minus 1, because it's this RL step we're always solving for new controllers. So in this step, we guess reward function. Our goal is to try to guess reward function that makes the expert look really good and make all the controllers we previously found look really bad. And it turns out that you can pose this in an optimization problem as follows. We're going to try to maximize what's called a margin parameter gamma so that the expected utility, or how well the expert is doing, is greater than or equal to, you know, anything we previously accomplished by a margin of at least gamma. Okay. And this is the assumption of a linear function approximation, and subject to that the reward function is a linear function of some set of features over the states. Turns out that this optimization problem is mathematically equivalent to the optimization problem you get if you use a support vector machine, which is sort of a standard machine learning algorithm. And so this is a convex optimization problem you can solve easily, and you iterate these two steps, and you end up with a good controller. So let me show you a few examples of results. The video on the left is exactly the same video as you saw earlier. And so given just this demonstration as input on the left, this is the output, the learned behavior that was learned by an algorithm trying to guess what Peter's reward function was, and then, you know, using that to run his own reinforcement learning algorithm. And I think it's actually fairly non-trivial to, you know, specify this sort of what qualitative driving style and it's actually fairly non-trivial, I think, to specify a reward function that captures this qualitative driving style and sort of try to mimic it. Couple more demonstrations. In each of these videos, the left panel shows a different driving style, and the right panel, left panel shows Peter demonstrating a different driving style, and the right sub-panel shows the resulting learned behavior. So in the video on the left, if you demonstrate the style of crashing into as many cars as you can, then yeah, given right. I think it's actually, and it's not entirely trivial to code up reward functions that capture all of these aspects. The other on the right, if you demonstrate a style of driving the right lane but veering off the road to avoid oncoming cars, then again, you know, it recovers a reward function that allows the algorithm to capture the sort of qualitative driving style. Students Peter Beal, Zika Coulter, and I worked on several different courses of apprenticeship learning algorithms. On the left here is a video of our little dog robot, and Drew and Chris and James here have won like this too, and they do different things on it, I guess. And this is an example of applying essentially the algorithm I described, the slightly embellished version of it. It's a bit more complicated in ways I won't go into, to get a low dog robot to learn to climb over obstacles, and games the reasonably non-trivial classes of obstacles to get over, I think. And then using various different classes of apprenticeship learning algorithms, not just the ones I just described, we've been working on a variety of other robots. I'm just going to play videos and not talk about algorithms, I guess. And I think CMU also, was it how you chose it here, also is a snake robot project. The motivation for snake robots, of course, is that I live in California, so if there's ever an earthquake, you need to go under the rubble to search survivors. Snake robots can, in principle, get into much smaller spaces than any other robot. So the learning, there's a side-winding gate at the end. And applying these algorithms back to the helicopter project, here are some examples of maneuvers that were flown. So this is a nose-in funnel maneuver in which the helicopter is flying in a circle, keeping it, so the helicopter is pitched forward slightly, so it cannot actually freeze in position in anywhere around the circle. This is a tail-in funnel maneuver in which it's now pitched steeply backwards. And so these are considered difficult aerobatic maneuvers for a helicopter to fly. I think CMU has done a nose-in circle as well. I'm actually not entirely sure. But I think we do a much more aggressive one than anyone else has done. There's a continuous in-place flip in which you are doing something you wouldn't want to do if you were sitting in the helicopter. think about it. It's actually remarkably difficult to specify a reward function for a maneuver like that. Continuous in-place row is similar to the in-place flips, but flipping sideways instead. And so all of these videos you just saw were sort of what arrived at using different versions of our different apprenticeship learning algorithms. Before I move on, let me just, for the sake of truth and absence, I say the four maneuvers I just showed you were what I consider to be fairly difficult maneuvers. Just for fun, I'm going to show you a bunch of other things we did. These are all autonomous flight videos, but what I'm about to show you are maneuvers that I actually consider fairly easy ones. So there's a forward flight row. It turns out that split S, this is a way of making a rapid 180 turn by diving down and then flipping over. So you then fly back the way you came from. Again, for the sake of full disclosure, these are fairly easy maneuvers because helicopters are stable at high speeds. Fly up, flip the tail, so you're pointing straight down. Then again, another way of making a rapid 180 turn. It's called. This is a loop, which is another fast forward flight maneuver, which you pull up, do a loop, and you continue on. And there's another one. Take off. Actually, this one, it turns out if you just increase the throttle, your helicopter will lift off. So take off is it's kind of cool to do still. And off it goes.
Are these all based on human, watching human?
Yeah, well, actually, we learn from human pilots in all the easy and hard maneuvers. So inverted takeoff. So.
For the more difficult ones you showed first, are those based on human pilots or?
So we learn from a human pilot demonstration, but the more difficult ones have a fairly complex sequence of algorithmic steps. We learn a model based on the human demonstration, and then we run our own flavor of a reinforcement learning algorithm. Reminiscent of DDP, for those of you that know what that is. Cool. So lastly, coming back to STAIR, using these sorts of algorithms, one of the first things we did on the robot was get the robot to navigate up to a door and open the door. Okay? And this is an unmodified door. And I should say, the really hard part of this wasn't probably even so much the control problem. I was continuously pushing the center of the door as it's moving in. But the harder part of this is probably actually the perception problem of reasoning about the map of the building at a very coarse level, 10 centimeter scale, and defining a unified probabilistic model that allows you to simultaneously reason about objects like the door at a 1 millimeter scale, so you can actually precisely grip the door handle and open it. Okay, let's next talk about object recognition on the StereoVan. So, turns out, I think human object recognition is far superior to that of any robotic vision system. And there are many reasons for this. One reason that computer vision researchers talk a lot about is the reason of contact, which people like Taralber and people here like Efres, Herbey, people here have worked on as well. And I think one other reason that human object recognition works much better is that humans use a fovea to fixate on an object, thus obtaining a very high-resolution image of it. And recognizing objects is much easier from high-res images. So for example, if I show you that picture and ask you what this object is, unless you're a computer vision researcher, I think you have a very hard time telling me. But with a high-res image, it becomes trivial to recognize what this is. Using a standard webcam, I mean, this is what a coffee mug looks like at the distance of 5 meters to a robot. So just be concrete about this, right? If I'm standing in front of you, I actually don't have, if I'm, say, facing this way, I actually don't have enough pixels to recognize that thing down there is a chair. For me to recognize that that's a chair, what I need to do is I need to turn my eyes at the chair, look directly at it, get a very high-res image of it, and then as I look away, I can still sort of track this, you know, reddish blob in my peripheral vision, and I still know it's a stair. Leisure?
So, Antonio, who was here a month ago or so, would argue that, in fact, even though you wouldn't recognize a cop when it's cropped, if you take the whole scene, then you would be very easy to recognize the cop given the whole scene without any foveation and any high-res stuff.
At the Cosine workshop in February, I made the mistake of giving this talk right before Antonio's. So I actually completely agree with him. And let me actually say, just because a human can do it doesn't mean it's easy. I think from a robotics viewpoint, if your goal is to build an object recognition system, I actually consider it low-hanging fruit to put a fovea on a robot. Lots of people have built foveas before. I consider it low-hanging fruit to put a fovea on a robot, which now allows you to look directly at objects and obtain high-res images of everything, and suddenly, you know, the object recognition problem at least becomes somewhat easier. I think it actually becomes much easier. Still hard, but much easier than it was before. So, turns out with off-the-shelf hardware, you can build a fovea with a panto zoom camera that can point at different objects and zoom in. We also use a fixed wide-angle camera to simulate the peripheral vision. And I guess, unlike object recognition on static images downloaded on the web, you know, if you're building a robot that can recognize objects, you know, fixate on objects to obtain high-res images of them. And we actually learn a foveal control strategy to maximize expected information gain. Yesterday, I told Carlos I only had one equation in the entire talk. He told me I should have more, so that's my second equation that I'm not going to talk about. I feel like for roboticists, if your goal is to place a camera, you know, in a retirement home to track people moving around, if your goal is to build a practical object recognition system today, I feel like putting a fovea on something is a sort of low-hanging fruit for boosting performance because you suddenly see the whole world in high res, and recognition becomes easier. So this is sort of an example of the fovea operating. This is on the upper right is the peripheral vision. It's a wide-angle, low-res camera. And this rectangle jumping around is where the fovea is moving. And so on the lower left is what the fovea sees. You can sort of tell. It's much easier to recognize a laptop or whatever from this high-res image than from this vague blur on the upper right. This is just showing the fovea. It's not the entire system in the loop. And if you evaluate this sort of algorithm more formally, you see that, you know, by plugging in this idea of a fovea, you get non-trivial performance boosts, so from, you know, 60 to 80, 85% precision recall. Those just recall. F scores from 40% up to 71%. Okay? So.
Middle.
Say that again?
Sorry.
Okay. Oh, just recall precision, yeah. So, lastly, so that was the second element of what we'd put onto our robot. Let me next talk about 3D perception. And this turned out to be a project that we had originally started on for purposes different from STAIR, but this ended up being sort of fairly tightly integrated onto one of the components of our robot. So let's talk about 3D perception. Given a single image like that, or a single image like that on the right, is it possible for an algorithm to recover a 3D model of the scene? Right? So traditionally, looking at a single image and recovering a 3D model of a scene was considered an impossible problem in computer vision. And I think most prior work in 3D reconstruction from vision focused on approaches like stereo vision, which I think often doesn't work very well. Other algorithms such as, dense stereo, which often doesn't work very well, especially in diesel environments. I'll show you examples later. And algorithms like structure for motion, depth from focus, defocus, all of which use multiple images and tend to have difficulty with certain types of scenes like these, I guess. There are a few other algorithms, things like shape from shading, which it turns out works great if your entire environment has the same color and texture, which is not true for anything like these. And things like 3D metrology, where you essentially go in and ask a human to hand code a bunch of things. There's a group at CMU, Derek Huang, Loisha Efforts, Marshall Urbe, that did some work in this space, so it's sort of contemporary to ours. I'll say a bit more about that later. But the question is, given a single image like this, or given a single image like that, can you automatically give a robot a sense of the 3D space around it? The advantage of monocular 3D reconstruction compared to stereo 3D reconstruction, of course, is that monocular depth estimates scale well to much longer distances. Right. So if you consider stereo depth estimation, this is sort of well known, that if I'm trying to estimate the depth of something that's fairly far away, then if I use stereo, then it's sort of a tiny error in estimating the angle of the object from each of my two eyes would translate into a huge error in the estimate of my depth. So stereo works great for estimating depths at short distances, but at long distances, stereo breaks down. Whereas if you can estimate depths from a single image, then you can sort of get a zoom lens and see 3D structure, even if it's extremely far, even if it's like miles away. So how do we do this? Took a machine learning approach in which we started by wandering around the Stanford campus and collecting a bunch of monocular images. And using a laser scanner, we also collected a set of ground truth depth maps. So this is a depth map where the different colors in this image indicate the different distances to the camera. And what we did then was apply a supervised machine learning algorithm to learn to estimate this depth map directly as a function of this input monocular image. Okay, so it turns out that if you so the question is, right, given this input image, can you have a learning algorithm output this sort of depth map? So it turns out that if you go to the psychological literature, there's some understanding of a number of cues that humans use to estimate depth from a single image. So for example, there are sort of texture variation cues. These are two different small patches taken from this large image, and you see that the texture here is very different, and this gives you a sense that maybe this is much closer than that. And texture gradient. There are other cues, like for example, the idea of haze. If you're outdoors because of scattering of light in the atmosphere, objects that are far away tend to appear slightly more hazy or a tinge of blue. And then there are other cues like defocus, known object sizes, and occlusion. So what we did was we tried to encode as many of these cues as we could. And realistically, I think we probably do a reasonable job capturing maybe the first two or three, tiny bit of some of the others, and probably not known object size and occlusion very well, at least in these versions of the model I'm going to show you. So after trying to implement as many features as we could, this is what we do. Given an image like this, we compute the image features, and we then construct a Markov random field model on top of the image features. So the Markov random field model looks like this. And concretely, what we're going to do is model a relation, a model function between the depth of position in the image and the local features of the image. Model the relations between depths of the same scale. So two adjacent pixels are more likely to be at similar depths, for instance. And we also model the relation between the depth sets of multiple spatial scales of the image. We apply supervised learning to train this entire model. And the output is the following. So these are examples of test set images in which the input to the algorithm is of a single monocular image like this. This is a ground truth depth map. And in the rightmost column is the estimated depth map output by the learning algorithm. So it makes actually kind of interesting errors. Ground truth depth map, this tree is actually very close to the camera. And so in the ground truth depth map, this is very close by. The algorithm misses it entirely. So a few more examples. Here in this picture, this bush is in the foreground. That tree is in the background. And the algorithm doesn't realize that. And instead, it takes this bush that's in the foreground and sort of smoothly blends it into the tree in the background without realizing these are two distinct objects. And so the algorithm makes interesting errors. Far from a flawless algorithm, but I think nonetheless, this is sort of another proof of demonstration, I guess, that from a single monocular image, you can get a reasonable sense of depth. Can evaluate these as well. I'm actually not going to talk about this at all, but it turns out that we measure errors on the multiplicative, sort of on the log scale, and on this basic model, the algorithm has about 35% error on average, sort of measured on a log scale. And it turns out that if you combine this with stereo, you do even better. So this is another example of an image. There's the ground truth depth map. If you apply the algorithm I just talked about using only monocular cues, that's the depth map you get. If you use sort of traditional off-the-shelf, classic dense stereo, that was the depth map we got using a stereo algorithm. You notice there are these huge swaths where there's very little texture, and so the stereo algorithm fails to find correspondences, and so doesn't output depths at all. And if you combine monocular and stereo cues together, then you actually get better performance than using either monocular vision or stereo vision alone. And so I think about this is that even if you have a very good stereo vision system on the robot, you can often do even better if beyond just using the geometric stereo triangulation cues, if you add to it the monocular depth estimates. We also evaluate this more formally, and so this is I don't remember what this is. I think this 20-something percent multiplicative error in which using mono you sort of get lower error than stereo alone or monocular vision alone by combining the two. So what I've shown is an algorithm.
In that table, the portion that stereo, for example, did not output. How was it evaluated in the evaluation of stereo, whereas mono, for each or all pixels, you have output?
Yeah, for the pixels where stereo did not output anything, we plugged in the mean value as a reasonable default. I should say this is done with sort of an I think a solid stereo implementation, but this is not this was not done with a state-of-the-art best possible stereo vision in the world. I think the statement I made earlier still holds true, though, that given essentially any stereo vision system, or at least a stereo vision system that relies primarily on triangulation cues, what I believe holds true is that by combining stereo triangulation cues together with the monocular depth estimation cues, you almost always do better than using only geometry alone or using monocular cues alone. But this, again, this is an OK stereo vision system, but not the best in the world. So what I've talked about so far was an algorithm that learns depth maps like these. So can we go further than that and actually learn nice, accurate 3D fly-through models? So let me briefly talk about this. Building on our early work, there's a group, I guess Derek Leuscher and Marshall at CMU have done related work. And so this later portion, I guess, takes sort of ideas from their work as well as our own earlier work. And what we wanted to do was see if we can take a monocular image like this and build a nice model that you can fly through. So what we do is the following. Take the image, and we use off-the-shelf superpixel segmentation software. We actually use Felsenschwab's software you can download off the web to take this image and it's called over-segment this image into many small regions. You notice that when you use an algorithm like these to over-segment the image, you notice that each of the patches here tends to lie on a single planar patch in the original image. So if you look at, say, a small, this white patch here, this white patch here actually corresponds to a small planar surface in the real image. It's only that this large planar surface has been fragmented into many small superpixels. So what we're going to do is actually run a superpixel segmentation algorithm, and then we're going to use the Markov random field again to take each of these small facets, or each of these small patches, and we're going to try to infer the 3D position and orientation of each of these small facets. Okay? I'm going to take this image, cut it up into lots of tiny pieces like this, and then we're going to try to infer the 3D position and orientation of each of these tiny patches of the image. So, some technical details. Turns out we do this using another probabilistic model called a Markov random field model that looks at superpixels and connects up each superpixel together with its neighbors. We actually implemented our MRF to capture a few more cues, such as local image features. So you see a blue patch, maybe it's the sky, that tells you it's further. You see a green patch, maybe it's glass, and so it's closer. We also try to encode in the MRF this idea that of coplanarity. So if you have two planes, like my hands, then there's a good chance that the two planes are actually going to be coplanar. They're sort of all lying on a single flat plane, except under certain circumstances, like this, where this may be a vertical wall connected to a horizontal ground. We also try to encode collinearity cues. Like if you see a long straight line in the image, then maybe that's a long straight line in your 3D model as well. So these are some of the cues we try to encode in our Markov random field model. And when you do that and run the most challenging part of this work is actually choosing a MRF parameterization so that computations in the Markov random fields, it's called inference computations, are so tractable and so can be done with linear programming. But when you do this, let me go ahead and show you a few examples of models we built. So the input to the algorithm is of a single image like this one, or this one, or this one. And I'm going to show you the so when you do this, this is an example of a 3D model that was built using the algorithm. Now I'm actually really bad at driving this VR player. So find the image, notice on the left the trees recede into the background more quickly. I'm going to find the image and turn to the left. Look at that tree. Oops, excuse me. Really badly driving this. And you know what? Let's try that again. And if you look at the tree on the leftmost of the image, you see that we actually capture a little bit of the 3D structure of the tree. To capture the fact that the tree has some 3D structure and so it bulges out in the middle.
So, but it's still planar. Each superpixel is approximate as a plane, right?
Yes.
So the tree is basically a bunch of little planes.
Yes, the tree is a bunch of little planes. Here's a second example. It's going to fly into the scene. Actually, let's get the reflections right. Right, we're actually on the lake. The reflections will change as you move, so we obviously get that wrong. Then I'm going to again turn left.
There are no waves on the water.
I know. Bummer. And so it sort of captures some of the 3D structure of the mountain. So this is unlike the earlier work of I guess Derrick and Loesch and Marshall, which sort of models things as being straight vertical surfaces. I'm just trying to capture more detailed 3D structure. And just show one more example of 3D model like this. And so we're standing in front of a fence building. This is a fence. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to squat down. And just imagine you're standing in front of this building. What we're going to do is we're going to squat down. And notice that the fence now comes up and it's now occluding the bottom half of the building. Stand up again and see that and squat down. And go slightly to the side, you notice that, there's this fence up here that is now blocking parts of the picture at the back.
Can you go up on it?
Shoot.
I'm trying to figure out if it's a step or a fence. It looks like a fence right now, but when you actually lift it up, it looks like a step.
I see. Yes, you're right. It turns out that, I think, yes, you're right. This should technically be a gap and then have a lower down floor.
So it's an occlusion, not a fall.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so you're right.
Why the bush was considered to be planar, I mean horizontal?
Oh, sorry, which bush? This one?
Yeah.
I don't know. This is far from perfect. I have no idea what it was doing.
No, I was impressed.
I see.
I just want to make it even better.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah, the sad thing about what we do is we do all of our things using a big learning algorithm. So we've gone back in and tried to figure out what the learning algorithm has learned, and it's actually, we've not been very successful at reverse engineering whatever cues the learning algorithm decided were the most important cues of 3D depth. It's sort of an unfortunate aspect of the data, purely data-driven machine learning things that we do, because we don't have as deep an understanding of computer vision as these guys. We just throw learning algorithms at it and see what happens. Finally, let me talk about grasping manipulation. So machine learning, Susie, I think robotics is an interesting state today. So robots can be scripted to perform amazing tasks in known environments. For example, here's a screenshot. This is done in Japan about 15 years ago. This is actually a screenshot I got off the History Channel. This is a screenshot of a robot balancing a spinning top, that red thing, on the edge of a sword. And this was done in Japan like 15, 20 years ago. Maybe Chris will know the date better than I do. But I hope you can see it, right?
A much more impressive one where robots actually throw the top.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, sounds like the sort of thing you do. So, right, so... What can you say? Right, so I hope you can see it. This red disc, this is a spinning top, this is a long spindle, and this is a sword, and it's balancing a spinning top on the edge of a sword. So, if this is an example of a solved problem in robotics, you know, what on earth is there left to do, right? So balancing a spinning top on the edge of a sword is a solved problem in robotics. Was an example of an unsolved problem in robotics. Well, it turns out that picking up that cup is an unsolved problem in robotics if you've never seen that cup before. Okay, and this is the problem we want to work on. So, given a cup or an object that you've never seen before, how do you pick it up? Well, one thing you could do is try to build a 3D model of this object. But it turns out that turns out to be fairly difficult. So on the STAIR project, we've been fortunate to have had sort of a large number of companies trying to donate hardware to us. So we're pretty good vision, we're pretty good stereo systems. And this is an example of a stereo def map that we got out of what I think is actually a fairly good stereo vision system. In which the different colors indicate different depths. I'm not sure you can see where the cup is. It's actually over there. And if you zoom in, this is a stereo depth map that we got, you know, off what I think is a fairly good stereo vision system of a cup lying on the desk. And black patches are where the stereo algorithm couldn't find correspondences and so didn't return any depths. This is enough of a mess. You can sort of barely tell. You actually probably can't even tell if the handle is on the left or on the right of the cup in this case. So I think it's fairly difficult to use things like stereo to build a 3D model of the cup. And even a stereo world, or even if you use structured light or active stereo or something, you get a model of only the front face of the cup. And if you know only the front face of the cup, you still can't do things like classical algorithms like form closure and force closure to pick up the cup. So what can you do? Remember that just now I said we could estimate depths from a single image. That is, even a single image gives you enough cues to estimate the 3D shape of a scene. So what we do is the following. We constructed a training set comprising five object types. And these five object types actually comprise the entirety of the training set we use. And for each of the objects here, we told the robot how to pick up the object. So we tell the robot, for pencil, pick it up there. For a wine glass, pick it up there. For a book, there. A whiteboard eraser, there. And for a cup, pick it up by a handle. What we did was we then apply a supervised learning algorithm, which can now use these single image monocular cues to try to get enough of a sense of the shape of these objects to maybe just decide where to grasp it from a single image. Then when it comes time to actually pick up a real object, this is what we do. We use, say, two images, or two or more images. See. And from, say, the left eye image, we then run our classifier to scan throughout this image and decide which point in this image corresponds to the point where we should pick up the object. And hopefully, the classifier will choose that point. Then you do the same thing for the right eye image. Scan through the entire image and look for the point that corresponds to where you should pick up the image. And hopefully, you'll find that point. And the algorithm can do this because, you know, from a single image, you can get some sense of the shape of the scene. What we do next is then take this point in your left eye and this point in your right eye. Right? So you have two image planes. Take one point in your left eye, one point in your right eye, and you then just triangulate these two points to obtain a position in 3D. And we should contrast this with dense stereo, which attempts to triangulate every single point in the image, and that's really hard. Instead, if you identify one point in each camera, then that gives you a much easier triangulation problem. You can actually identify a point in 3D. Full disclosure, the actual algorithm we use is slightly more complicated than this because there are often multiple points in the left eye and multiple points in the right eye, so you still have to solve some sort of correspondence problem, which we do using a big Bayes' net, blah, blah, blah. But skipping the details, this is the basic approach. And what I'm going to show here is a video of a robot perceiving a variety of objects for the first time. So this robot is seeing a variety of objects for the first time using this sort of cheap webcam. This is like a $90. This is a webcam that we bought off the shelf from an electronics store. And is sort of understanding the 3D shape of these objects well enough using the algorithm I showed you to pick them up. Again, full disclosure, this, on our test sets, this worked 88% of the time. And if you remember the training set objects, well, we had five objects, pencils, martini glasses, whiteboard erasers, books, there's one more. And many of these objects are, I think, very different from anything in the training set. And at least for 88% of the time, it understands the 3D shape of these sort of fairly strange things. Bought this from a dollar store. I'm still not sure what it is. understands the 3D shape of these objects well enough to pick them up. And just for fun, we actually also applied this algorithm to trying to unload items from a dishwasher. And I think Sid earlier today and James earlier today were telling me about related dishwasher efforts elsewhere, Intel in Germany. But these are objects that the robot has not previously seen and were sort of not in the training set. But when you apply same sort of algorithm, it's again not always, but frequently. Learns to recognize the 3D shape of these objects well enough to identify a point at which to grasp the object and select a point to grasp the object and pick it out of the dishwasher. And we move the camera from the arm to that's the stereo pair of cameras, the Bumblebee stereo pair of cameras. Right? And so there, this goes on. So one thing that I'm not going to talk about at all on the STAIR project is that we also built, using the same sort of reinforcement learning algorithm, we also built a spoken dialogue system so you can talk to the robot. And finally, the components I talked about today were this sort of mobile manipulation, plus object recognition using a fovea, plus 3D perception, which you use for grasping, and then this sort of spoken dialogue system. And so I said at the beginning of the talk that on the STAIR project, the problem we've been going for is giving the robot to understand and execute a command like STAIR, please fetch my statement from the lab. And so tying these together, let me show you a video. And the video I should show you, you should consider the video I show you to be a demo and not a sort of fully working system that already evaluated formally. So, excuse me. Okay. And so this is my student Morgan, who wrote all this, who wrote a lot of software on the robot. So again, this is a demo. This is not a working, rigorously tested system. Instead of using the usual indoor navigation things to find his way.
Some ragtime piano music.
One of my students put techno on one of the videos, and I'm still teasing him about it. So, so sorry, there was a phobia looking around and recognizing a stapler. And the PandaZoom was looking around to try to find a stapler. I think it's found it. That's the object recognition, I guess, recognizing the stapler. When I say we want to do a stapler, one of my students took all the staplers out of the training set for learning to grasp. So this was an actual grasped attempt. That was trained on objects that did not include staplers. And so it picks up the stapler, heads back to Morgan, and so, to conclude, I guess, start off describing the STAIR project's motivation as, to build a single robot platform is just a challenge problem that will require integrating tools from all of these different sub-areas of AI. And then for the course of the talk, I ended up talking about a large number of different projects with helicopters, learning controllers, apprenticeship learning, phobia for computer vision that we use to find the stapler, depth perception, grasping to find the stapler, spoken dialogue, and so on, that we are, I guess, integrating onto the STAIR robot platform and having it, fetch items from around the office. That's actually my and just briefly mention as future work, one of my colleagues, Ken Salisbury, has built a very mechanically capable two-arm robot. This is all Ken's work that we're hoping to use as the next version of STAIR. It's a more mechanically capable robot to do more interesting things as well. And let me just conclude by mentioning the names of especially the student leads that did the work I just told you about. Student leads in the various projects were Peter Abiu, Adam Coates, Zico Coulter, Yi Rong Shen, Ashraf Saxena did all the monocular work and the grasping work. Morgan Quigley, Anya Pichovskaya, Stephen Gould, and sort of many others here who've contributed to the STAIR project. So that's all I have. Thank you very much. Questions? Is that right?
Particularly, so if you go up to the slides with it, one of the ones that had the building in the background.
Oh, I see.
Your reconstruction actually caught that one, yeah. Reconstruction actually caught the building that the laser did not.
Yeah, you're right. No, yeah, you're right. So technically, the laser only goes up to roughly 80 meters, and the building was slightly beyond that. So this light blue is supposed to mean 80 meters or greater distance. So technically, ground truth is actually more correct, and it means in the strict sense, because the building is actually far away enough, it should be colored light blue. And our algorithm thought the building was somewhat closer than it actually was. So yeah.
But her point is correct. For the robotics purpose, knowing something is probably important than not knowing it's there.
I see. Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think,
Although if it's 80 meters away, then you probably don't necessarily need to know until you're 60 meters, and then you'll see it, so maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but I think this is sort of a limitation of our sensor, right? The right thing to do is actually to build a model that extends out to further ranges than 80 meters, and then rerun the learning algorithm so you can actually detect things at larger distances.
This ground truth is actually weird because the sidewalk looks like it's closer than the grass, right? There shouldn't be an edge between the sidewalk and the grass.
Oh yeah.
Is it an error of your laser?
Actually, good question. I don't know. Maybe the laser reflects differently off sidewalk and glass. Okay. Right? The sick laser is
so
a bit.
This is again. You're doing better than the.
I see. Yeah. I don't know. It was very generous. I'm not that.
We are a general audience.
Yeah. Sit. Yeah.
In your dishwasher unloading example, did the robot ever try to unload the dishwasher tray itself?
Boy, no. So. What did we do? So the algorithm was exactly what I told you. We added some things to the training set, so that actually had examples of items in the dishwasher, but different from the test set objects you saw. And so the algorithm is that it'll look at the objects in the dishwasher, and it'll select a point in the dishwasher to attempt to grasp. And for now, it's a fairly dumb algorithm. It has no explicit strategy of deciding, to unload this first, then that first, then that. What it does is it just looks around and says, okay, what's the easiest object to take out of the dishwasher, and I'll just go for that. And so I guess it was trained so that it doesn't really go for the prongs. It goes for other objects. At least that's the behavior we've seen so far. We haven't seen it try to pull out the prongs in the dishwasher.
Mm-hmm. Do you just take a bunch of pictures of the same? Like, how do you guarantee that you get depths, many
different
depths represented in your test set? Is it the same
day that you take the test? All the images were taken around Palo Alto, largely on Stanford campus, with a few in downtown Palo Alto as well, I think. I'm trying to remember what we did. But the training test sets were taken from different areas of Stanford campus, so we're fairly careful. The training and test sets were taken on different areas of Stanford campus. But on the other hand, it is true, a lot of it is sort of Stanford campus, and Stanford campus is, it's fairly alike, I guess. I see. Yeah, you may want to. So it turns out we also downloaded a bunch of internet images and tried the same algorithm on a bunch of internet images, and like anything else, it doesn't always work, but it often does very well, even on internet. But the problem of internet images is that we don't ever have ground truth depth maps for internet images, so we couldn't evaluate it more formally on things from the web. A lot. So yeah, it's a great question actually. So what if we take the Markov random view model and break all the horizontal links and essentially just run a local logistic regression classifier? The results are definitely worse, and you end up with depth maps that become much noisier and I don't have a picture here, but the results are definitely worse. We've tried that test. Chris?
So I don't mean to offend all my vision. But your colleague, Sebastian Thrun, has made quite a career recently of pointing out that vision is irrelevant if you just have a laser scanner. And in fact, you're telling us you got ground truth from a laser scanner. So why is it this is a problem worth solving?
You want to take that? No, so what is it? There are lots of things you can do with vision that you can't with lasers. Right? So active sensors only go out to limited ranges. A sick laser scanner goes out to maybe 80 meters or so.
Yeah, we just got through saying that buildings are so far away they're irrelevant.
Yeah, and so if you're moving at high speeds, or if you have a small robot that can't carry this big, heavy, sick laser, or even some of the more lightweight lasers, like a Hokuyo laser or whatever. For better or worse, the cheap, cameras are still some of the cheapest sensors in the world. And it's true, actually. For the STARE project, we do have a laser, and we plan to use laser to get a depth map and combine that with vision. We don't have the cool laser that the CMU helicopter team has, the cool laser that gives color as well. Yeah.
No, actually, with laser makes a mistake very confidently. That's the problem. In other words,
but here, if I was a little flying thing or a little robot, I'd much rather know that the branch is right in front of me, that red stuff, than miss it entirely.
But think of things like a water, mirror-like object. Then laser, as I said, makes a very confident mistake. Do you understand what I mean? In other words, stereo actually is doing okay. The problem. Stereo actually, when it homogeneous, regions, it doesn't output, which is good, because it does not know. Therefore, it says that it does know. Whereas laser, if it's a mirror-ish object, it actually gives you a very wrong data, confidently.
Just like our president. That's great.
did we get that on tape?
Well, we got much more authority.
So, as someone who has been involved with lasers for very long, I'll give you one data point. Okay? For the past 35 years, since a paper by Jerry Aiden and Tom Binford, we have said that using laser launch rifles will solve all the problems of our world. Here we are now.
Yes. By the way, we said that in Vision 2.
I have a more philosophical kind of question. I understood that you were implying that there are a lot of certain areas of artificial intelligence that you are trying to put together, and one of them, for example, is controls. And I'm sure you've heard this question from other people in the past. Why do you consider controls to be artificial intelligence? And there are other areas for which I put the same question. I don't mean to start a semantic war here. Just wanted to hear your understanding of why controls is a sub-area of AI.
Yeah, I guess I have colleagues that I have one colleague, Vaughn Pratt, who goes so far as to say that even Excel spreadsheets is an instance of making computers intelligent and computers artificial, therefore Excel spreadsheets are AI. Vaughn actually said that. But I think those of us that work in AI, we're engaged in the endeavor of building systems that exhibit intelligent behavior. And there are two approaches to it, both of which I like very much. One is going after the goal of human-level AI, which I wish more of us would think about more often. What does it take to build systems that are as intelligent as humans? And this is a dream that many of us have lost track of and I think would be well served by thinking about more often. And then there's the other sort of mimicking the biology approach, which I think Mike might be sympathetic to, building an artificial human brain, if I put it in a somewhat overly grandiose way. And then there's the more engineering approach of working out algorithms, like why is A star an instance of artificial intelligence? And I think many those of us that work in AI are very happy calling things like Markov random field models and reinforcement learning and A-star search and strips planning. I think many of us call these things AI because they make our systems exhibit intelligent behavior. Okay, here's this question.
I had a question about learning of the reward functions earlier in the talk. So it seems to me that the hardest part of figuring out the reward function is figuring out what the things you're trying to optimize are, not necessarily the weights in front of them. And it seems like your algorithm is more tuned to you give it a set of things you're interested in, and then it just finds the weights that you like the most.
Yeah, that's a fair criticism. So in the case of finite state MDPs, the result is actually fully general, because the usual lookup representation for reward functions. And otherwise, I feel like it's like, for better or worse, it's like any supervised learning, like a currency of the arts in supervised learning. If you want to do text classification, you want to apply some supervised learning algorithm, sadly, our algorithms today still largely require that we construct the features and give features the algorithm. So it's sort of no different from that. I think that's fascinating work in automatic feature construction, which would be cool to explore, but we haven't done that.
All right. Marshall has a question.
Marshall?
Yes. Since this is the end of the semester, I think we should thank Alosha for an excellent selection for the seminar series and recognize the fact also that he has given us the longest and most elaborate speaker introduction in the history of the instruction during the semester. And thank you.
There is a GG starting at 5, I think, in the Neil Simon atrium, and it's supposed to be a fancy one. 5:30? Yeah. So they're supposed to have good stuff that might not even run out like 4 or 5 minutes. So
I suppose to what?
Yes.
Andy, you mentioned that there are many proposals.
Dairy proposal, yes. Dairy proposal.
Wonderful talk.